Okay, great. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Okay. So, you know, you may get sick of what I'm going to say before you come to the end, and that's okay. So let's just see how far I get. So a bunch of people who have worked with me over the years. I think Corey is here. Okay. Yeah. Okay. Mark is there too, but not on this sheet because he didn't do Grindr. Okay. So let me just set a context for what I'm going to tell you. And part of the trick is, of course, so let's see, I think I see one other experimentalist here, maybe another here and there. So the picture is going to be a little bit different from the frictionless case that is often studied theoretically. And so what I'm going to tell you is really in the context of experiment. Okay. So I think one of the interesting challenges is how you merge theoretical and experimental views on some of these issues. And so I think that is a very interesting challenge. So at any rate, when you look in experiments, and oftentimes in models too, what you will see is certain structures. Historically, they were called force chains, but I think force networks is a better description of what they are because they don't always look like chains. So at any rate, when you shear your system, a granular system, then what you tend to do is you develop an anisotropic network, and that's the sort of thing that people call force chains. When you deform the system, then it will oftentimes break, and so that can lead to large spatiotemporal fluctuations, and that in fact is why I got interested in, a large reason why I spent a lot of time trying to understand what goes on in these shear granular systems. Particles with friction will dilate, and you will form shear bands, which are not only planes of slip, but which are planes of dilation. They obviously jam, and so of course that's been a subject where a number of people here have contributed significantly. These are frictional, I mean, whenever I do an experiment, okay, I can do experiments with low friction, but I always have friction. I can never get rid of it, and that leads to interesting consequences, and I'll hopefully tell you about that. Okay. So, at any rate, so shear leads to force networks, okay, so this is a picture often pirated by people. They will, you know, after I tell them the real story, they hate it, but no. Okay, anyway. So this is you're looking down on top of a Couette shear experiment. The system has been sheared by rotating an inner wheel, and so the test, your first test to see if it will pass to the next stage is which way was the wheel rotated. Okay, and so you can actually tell from this picture, but it doesn't matter so much for the moment. You have this force network. Red means strong force on a grain. This is real experimental data, false colored. Okay. Blue means low force.
Okay. Bob, just the details. So I see some chains coming in perpendicular up in the upper right corner for the inner wheel. You see?
Yeah.
But then on the other side.
Down here in particular, yeah.
They're sort of parallel.
Yep.
Any
inside? Sure, if you want. So typically, this is the compressive direction, which is how I can tell which way it was rotating. What tends to happen is as you rotate the wheel around, the force chains will also tend to be sheared with it for temporarily. And so then they will come in more normally after that. And by the way, Stefan could show a companion picture. So the first collaboration I had with Stefan was where he and a student was working on simulating this experiment. So it goes back a ways. Okay. So I'm going to tell you a little bit more, but the whole point is you're looking at collections of quasi-2D particles. These are placed between cross-polarizers. There's a light source from over here, and when you look through the cross-polarizers of these special photoelastic materials, when there are contact forces, the particles have patterns, and the pattern actually encodes in a quantitative way what the forces are acting on the particle. So that is important. And so then these kinds of structures appear in all sorts of different systems. If you care to look, of course, if you don't have cross polarizers the way Superman does, you don't see them. Okay. All right. So when you shear that kind of system, whether it's in 2D or in a fully 3D system, you generate large stresses, presumably because of how you are deforming and breaking these force chains. These are from that 2D Couette experiment I just showed you, but if you do a similar 3D experiment where Corey actually worked as an undergrad, right, you see comparable fluctuations in this, in the pressure. These are normal force fluctuations, as here they're also normal force fluctuations, pressure. You see them in Hopper flow. This was, in fact, the experiment that got us most interested in the statistical properties, because Dave Schaefer was analyzing engineering equations, and he said, look, there is inherent instability in what is used in soil mechanics. Go look for it in your shear flow, and you'll find a characteristic time signature at a frequency which is set by the shear rate. So we're looking at a flow in a hopper at pressure fluctuations, and there is no characteristic frequency, but there's a heck of a lot of noise. Okay. All right. Good. Okay. So the third bullet item of sort of setting context was the fact that physical grinding materials dilate when you shear them. There's reason to think that if the particles are frictionless, that's not the case, but the effect was discovered actually by Osborne Reynolds. This was, you know, so this gives us all hope. So he was, I forget how old he was, but he was pretty old when he discovered this. Long past the Reynolds number fluid effect, right? So he did this classic experiment. He put particles in an elastic bag, put a transparent tube on top of the bag and filled the whole thing with water and sheared it. Okay, and so then, of course, the second question, which will get you to the next part of the talk if you get it right, is what happened to the fluid? Okay, so of course you should get it. If the material dilates, the liquid level drops. Okay, so the in this experiment, the classic experiment by you know this famous guy back you know well over 100 years ago now, he actually showed dilation. Okay, if you again go back to that shear experiment and look at a segment of the system. This was, you know, again, looking down, there's a bit of that inner shearing wheel. You shear the system, and after some modest length of time, the particles nearest that moving surface have been pushed out. That clearly means, I mean, this is manifestly a reduction in density here, right? The volume of the system is constant, so what you've done is push the particles out much, much more densely in the outer part. But that's a footnote, in a way. And so Jean-Marie Roux has shown, in fact, that in a frictionless particle model, that you don't get dilation. Okay. All right. So that's maybe a key difference. Friction does matter. Okay. And so this is how you totally destroy your teaching evaluations, right? Okay. So some of you have seen how to do this before. Okay. So you tell your students that there's a brick sitting in a corner like so, and you ask them for the forces on the brick. You tell them there's friction, okay? Okay, and so the answer is you can't tell. You cannot tell. Because, after all, I could have slid the block down like so. So I ended up in this configuration with friction mobilized up that way. That means there's a frictional force acting tangentially. But there would be no frictional force acting on the brick from that surface, right? I could equally well have slid the block down from that way. If I had done so, I would not be able to tell by looking at the location of this brick that there was friction now acting up here as opposed to here. Right? So positions are no longer adequate to determine the forces acting on frictional particles. The brick is just a simple example. The whole issue appears if you've got spheres or disks or whatever. Once you add friction into the mix, knowing where the particles are sitting will not tell you the forces, the total force acting on the particle. Okay, so that leads to, you know, let's say it's an extra spice in the system. Okay. If you want, you can play a game like this. Okay, so this is both a reminder that if you have frictional particles, then you have vector forces at contacts. Those can involve friction. So in this case, there are three particles with 9 force and torque constraints. And because of the frictional force, there are 10 unknown force components. So they're actually, in this case, there. This again would be the problem that would blow the minds of your freshman physics students if you told them find the forces acting on these three particles, because the answer is there's actually a continuum of solutions that are admissible for this. If you've got gravity acting on them. So at any rate, in this case, there are more degrees of freedom than there are constraints. Okay, so the system would be jammed. I can sit at the isostatic state where I have an exact match between the number of degrees of freedom and constraints. that would tell me, if you like, by sort of Maxwell counting, that there's a magic number of contacts, the isostatic number of contacts at which the system will just have degrees of freedom and constraints matched. Okay, so isostaticity, and this is a very important aspect of what goes on. So you have to match the iso, and you don't have to actually match phi, the packing fraction of the system. That's not a constraint on the system, okay, but the z has to be at least something which depends on whether you have friction or not. Okay. So, all right. So I'm zooming by a lot of this, okay, because I'm assuming that large fractions of the people here know most of this and could actually give the lecture perhaps better than I can. So I actually want to contrast two pictures, okay? So the one on the right, which also has not quite this diagram, but one where Corey and Andrea Liu and Sid Nagel and Leo Silbert did a lot of computations. So on the right you have a jamming diagram where you have the packing fraction of a system of grains, these are spheres, and the shear stress. And the idea is that if you're dense enough, at zero shear stress, there is a line of jammed isotropic states. And if you shear them, which makes them anisotropic, so think long force chains, the system can remain jammed until you meet, you get up to a yield surface where the system breaks under the influence of shear stress. Okay. All right. So there's one picture of jamming. And I'm going to go over to one which is more relevant to many practical applications, which is flow out of a hopper. Okay, so this is a funny hopper because you can look in and see what the forces are by photoelasticity. But it's still, I think, a pretty good model for what happens in a real hopper flow. And so actually, what happens is this system jams, okay, and if you look at the density at which it jams, okay, it actually is below what you might expect for frictionless particles. And I'll try to come back to that. And it also has a fair degree of anisotropy in the force network structure. It actually jams as a result of flow, and so if you think about it, in this kind of system, there's flow out of the hopper, where the flow is fastest in the center, and then it moves more slowly along the walls. So actually what you have is sort of a central shear region. It's sort of like a shear band, a double shear band, anyway. Okay. So I just want to raise the question, is there any connection here? And what I'm going to suggest is that the connection can be made by a different kind of jamming diagram, which is something that Max B and Jay Zhang and Bubel and I have sort of put forward a few years ago based on experimental data. And so then if you start at the frictionless isotropic phi J, you can go downward to lower phis, generate states which are anisotropic and which are robustly jammed. Okay. Meaning you can actually also reverse the shear that you use to create them, and they will not instantaneously unjam.
Can you say phi J point assumes there's friction or not?
This is frictionless. So you can actually get to this point in a frictional experiment, okay, by tapping and relaxing the friction. Okay, so we have a decent idea for our system where that is, and then we take our same particles, go to lower packing fractions, and generate jam states by shearing. I'll show you that. So
you need friction.
You need that's of course part of the point of yesterday's last second talk, right? What is the role of friction in that? Okay, and that's a challenge that I think we're still trying to unravel. But I think both Stefan Luding and Corey and so forth will have something to say before long. Okay, so what is the role of friction in this? But it is certainly true that if you add friction, it is much, much easier to generate these states. Whether it's essential or not, I think is still something that's being debated.
Fragile means jammed only in one direction.
Right. So I famous last words, I'll come back to that, but indeed the idea is, think about those force chains, they're generated by shearing in one way, and now I could imagine, particularly my particles are very hard, I reverse strain, and all that will go away, And until I shear backwards far enough, the system will revert to an unchained state. Yeah?
Also, I just want to understand. Are you saying the left diagram, the original diagram, is incomplete, or it's just a different system?
Well, it's a different system, right?
So okay. How are they different?
The key difference is whether you have. So this is done for friction null particles, and this is done for friction less. And now the remaining question is, are there other states in this frictionless diagram where you can also get jamming by shear? That's the piece that I think we're still working on. But I would say fairly unequivocally, if you have particles with friction, this is the kind of picture you get. The fragile states may not, so there may be, I think Corey would say that there are fragile states of sorts, which are not necessarily the same as the fragile states that we get by shearing. But they're still fragile, I think. That is, they could be jammed, but they're very susceptible to additional strain.
And just a clarification, the green and gray line, that line is not a real line. It's just showing that was the old picture and this is the new picture.
Like, yeah. Right. There's no
line separating the green and the gray.
So you can simply walk from one side to the other. You won't know that you did.
Yeah, the distinction is only at zero tau.
Right. So
along that line.
So green and dark gray are all part of the same.
Could you briefly explain on the left why the curve goes to the right? Is that because the particles are compressed?
Yeah. So in order to break a system by shearing it, okay, you have to make the particles move around them, mm-hmm. and so the more tightly you compress them, the harder it is, and therefore the more shear stress you need to make it flow.
If you have incompressible particles,
then that's it.
Then you can't even go there, right?
Yeah. So this is all assuming that you have particles with finite elasticity. Yeah.
And that would be your yield stress line if you came from the floor.
Yeah, this is still the yield stress line. Mm-hmm. This is still a yield stress line. Okay.
How do you take in consideration the protocol, the preparation of the sample in this diagram that we discussed yesterday?
Well, we use a protocol to get where we lie, right? But at the end of the day, there are, if you like, state variables which describe that system. So there are presumably multiple ways of getting to these states. Once you're there, okay, then you have well-characterized macroscopic system properties. Okay, is that?
Yeah.
So protocol is important, and that's how we got to these states, was by choosing a protocol. But I think it's reasonable to say that if you get into this region, you will get an ensemble of states which are consistent with the states we have.
Okay. Well, Bob, I have a quick question.
Yeah, sure.
Do you think that there are unjammed states that exist in the green region?
Unjammed states that exist in the room? I doubt it. I mean, don't forget, I mean, this is also a heuristic state. This is a statement that you can go from states which would fall apart with small amounts of additional strain. And you arrive in a region where you have states which don't fall apart.
I guess the question is whether...
It could be a very fuzzy boundary.
I'm wondering if this diagram you're thinking of has fixed friction coefficient.
Yeah.
Because if you're imagine you're at left, like this was for low friction coefficient, then I'm thinking actually shoot.
There's another axis coming out here, which would be the friction axis if you want. I could change. I can't change friction on the fly in general. Well, actually, I can. But I mean, in general, it's hard to change. For the particles that we used, I can't change friction on the fly. Okay, but I could have, I could come out here with U as another axis, okay, which would then presumably allow me to merge, meld in a picture like that, which would be out here at zero. This would be at, a half. And then I could go to infinity. Each one of these would have its own slice of a three-dimensional jamming picture.
So, if you're doing that, what would be happening by S, and also the
well,
height of if you define a tau star,
Is that tau star?
Yeah. This will have a scale on the
way. Yeah.
What might we expect, I guess?
Right. So this phi S will move towards phi J. And so the real question, I would say, is does phi S equal phi J when mu goes to zero? Okay. And then, of course, the tau star issue is also tricky, right? So that actually may stay moderately constant, but okay. But for sure, phi s more moves towards phi j when you reduce mu. I'm sorry, no. I got a hold of that.
Which is, has an experiment been done where you do use different fictional.
Yes, I'll show you. Okay. So I just want to take a detour. This is probably safe and won't generate too many questions because there are very few experimentalists here. Okay. So, all right. So how does this work? What is useful here? I want to go back to this picture. You're looking at particles which are birefringent under strain. Okay. So they're typically, if you remember on Monday, Corey passed around a little demo which may even have been made with Duke particles or something.
They were Duke particles.
Yeah. Okay. So we have, for whatever reason, nobody seems to be able to make these, which is I don't understand, except us.
Because you bought all of them off the market.
Yes, we went to God and bought them. Never mind. Okay. And no one else seems to talk to God. Okay. So, all right. So the idea is you have these materials, you push on them, you develop stresses inside, and so then what does that do for you? Okay. So let me just show you what that looks like. This is the hand, the hand, well, not maybe not God, Yahweh, but Joshua. Okay. So now you pick up one of these particles. Okay, you can see the scale of this particle. Okay. These are our biggest particles, which is what we have, smaller ones of those. And when you push on it, then you develop these fringes. The fringes are encoding the force acting on the particle. So just some history, right? So this was again one of these, British dead men. Okay, whatever. So this was an effect that was discovered by Brewster of Brewster's angle, and it was actually used for granular systems some time ago. And as far as I can tell, the first person who really did it was a guy in Japan, and he had the misfortune of being in Japan during the war. So whatever he was doing didn't come out until afterwards. And so in that roughly that same time period, Pierre Lantier, who was at Pont-de-Chaussée, did really, really elegant experiments, also using photoelastic particles. So in between, it was used by various people, so Andy Drescher and so forth, and collaborators oftentimes. The trick was that relatively recently, So this is the paper with the big blue eye. What we were able to do is use it as a local tool to measure forces at the particle scale. So that's what we've done. And then somewhat more recently, we made a more sophisticated analysis of what goes on. And so the trick is that, order 8, 9, 10 years ago, we created ways of actually measuring contact forces between grains. So now you can do the kind of analysis experimentally that one might be able to do from a theoretical model, but you have physical particles in hand. So again, the basic principles are, I take some incoming intensity, I'm shooting it along the axial direction of my disk here, for instance, and the amount of light transmitted, again, this is using cross-circular polarizers, is then dependent on the interior stresses within the particle. Right? So these are the principal stresses in the plane of the particle. There's a material dependent coefficient from the polymer you use, the particle thickness, and the wavelength of light that you use. Okay, so it has this particular form. It's several page, a very boring calculation to go through. That's what it is. And so, of course, as the shear stress inside the particle grows, the density of fringes grows, and the trick is, of course, point forces generate shear stresses inside the particle. Okay, this is classical elasticity. If I had exact point forces acting on the particle, I can write down a very simple equation for disks, what that elastic stress field is inside the particle. That's actually what we use, but you can use more complex models that include the fact that if you squeeze hard, the contacts start to flatten. Okay, so here's the deal, right? If I know contact force is acting on a particle, then I know the stresses inside the particle. That means I know the transmitted light intensity pattern, okay? And right, so I know the pattern if I know the forces, so just run that backwards, right? So if I run that backwards as a nonlinear fitting routine, I get the contact forces acting wherever the contacts are. So I obviously have to know that, and I also know that every particle is in force and torque balance. So, you know, that actually reduces significantly the number of degrees of freedom I have to deal with. Okay. So we start with color images, okay? So the color images are particularly attractive because the photoelastic response is color dependent. So the fringes look kind of amusing, different, whatever you want to call them, artistic to some people's eye, and but you need to filter, okay, because you have to only, if you try to use the full color response, you're looking at a mush. So you filter your image here for green because that's what the polarizer is like. You carry out on each particle this inverse algorithm, and this tells you how well you are doing by comparing this to the original image. Right? So this is a fitted image, that's a real image. Okay, so now we're off in the business of looking at whatever you want to look at, such as the contact forces. So this, I think Corey mentioned yesterday, that you have a finite value of P of F at zero force. You have this initial linear, whatever, well, some, I mean, I'm attributing this to wrong force. Anyway, so and then roughly exponential decay. Of course, you know, unlike sort of theoretical pictures, there's a tangential force, right? The tangential force has a habit of always being exponential, although there's maybe a tiny bump.
Given the algorithm you introduced, does that mean that the sort of sensitivity or the error bars on the tangential and normal forces are the same?
Yeah, to the lowest order, but the fractional error bars, of course, are different because the actual amount of the tangential forces is always less than the normal force.
The absolute magnitude of that.
Yeah, it should be comparable, right? Yeah. Okay. So now we're in the business of doing, whatever you would like to do, such as computing stress tensors, as dynamic product of branch vectors and contact forces, fabric. You can also create if this is your stress tensor, then if you forget the normalization factor by the area associated to each particle, then it becomes a force moment tensor. And then sort of, if that has not totally put you to sleep, wake up and remember that the pressure is the trace of this stress tensor and the shear stress is the difference of the principal stresses. Okay. All right. Good. Okay. We also need to use track rotation in these systems. Okay, so, but at the same time, you don't want to put something on your particle that will mess up the photoelastic pattern. Okay, that would be awkward because you're trying to use the details of that pattern to measure contact forces. Okay, so what we actually do is we put a mark on it, all right, but we do it in your favorite little underlined marker pen. Okay, so these fluorescent marker pens. Those are nearly transparent. They almost match the color of the particles, but when you hit it with UV light, then they shine very brightly. So at the end of the day, we'll have a system with all the particles. You can just barely see the bars on these. So we'll take three images at one state. These are all very slow measurements. They're all basically quasi-statics. You move the system a little bit and take images of photoelastic, unpolarized, and UV eliminated particles, so you know the state of the system, everything. Okay, famous last words. There's always experimental error, right? But you know, in principle, whatever you want to know about the system. Okay.
So I didn't understand the light, going so fast.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah, okay. I'm trying, because I want to cover 500 slides before that. I'm sorry.
Okay.
Yeah, so at least.
I think we're all there. So, what's the light panel?
The right panel. That's what you see when you illuminate the particles with UV light.
Okay, so what is that bar?
That's the fluorescent marker bar.
So you're tracking rotation.
You're tracking the particles rotate when you push the system.
Is the bar some region that's sensitive to UV?
Yeah. Right. So go back to this is the artistic representation, right? So the idea is you take, you've marked your every particle beforehand. You know, this is sort of first grade work. You get your fluorescent marker pen and a ruler, and across the diameter of every particle you draw a little bar. Okay. So then at the end of the day, then when you illuminate from above with UV light, those marks are bright. Okay.
Once you start out with they're all parallel.
Oh my goodness, no. Okay, no, they're thrown in wherever they are. Okay, but we track what they do.
And just track how they have you.
Yeah, because, you know, these are disks, so there's no preferred orientation. Okay, but, so we put them in with whatever orientation they have. Okay, but we're doing things to the system and we care how much rotation there is in the process. And the rotation is driven by the frictional force. So if Corey was doing this with his frictionless particles, you wouldn't have to worry about this because there's no friction and there's no rotation. Okay,
but the gears can slide or rotate.
They can do whatever, right? And so we want to be able to track whatever they do. Okay, so right? Yeah, sure. Okay, yeah. So yeah, and again, I'm, you know, tell me to slow down if I'm going fast, right? So right. Okay. So now you need to do something with this, right? Okay, so all this technique is not worth much if you don't have something to say about it. So this happens to be a particular experiment which we call a biaxial tester. This is totally confusing to people who do soil mechanics, but not physicists who understand the idea. So the idea is I have, say, a rectangular shape whose dimensions are controlled by the distances between two boundaries, and I'm just going to be able to control the separation of this distance and of that, those two boundaries, independently, and so I can apply strains which of any type I want. And so I could do isotropic compression, which means I move in both boundaries equivalently, or I can do shear, which means that I push one way, expand in the other, but I keep the area constant, right? And I'll call that pure shear. You know, there's differences in what people use, and I'll talk about what I'll call simple shear, which in a bit, which is, I mean, something different. Okay. So one of the first things we did with this system then was to look at the isotropic jamming case, but for our frictional particles, the friction is about a half or so. And I'm not going to tell you about that because if I anneal out, if I relax my system, I can get a jamming picture which looks pretty much like what you would get if I had frictionless particles. Okay. So I'm not going to tell you about that, but if someone really wants to know about that, they can ask. Okay. So rather, okay, and so someone was asking about fragility, I think. So rather, I'd like to look in a different regime, which is, I think, is something which is literally out of the jamming diagram box. And so the idea is, I know that around 0.84 in two dimensions, I can find a system such that any density above that, okay, isotropic state is jammed, and I can go below, so this is 1/Packer fraction, so I can go to lower Packer fractions, and I discover I just put the particles in and relax all the forces that it's unjammed. And I want to ask what happens when I shear that kind of system. And the context that I want to look at is a paper which actually preceded the Lou-Nagel jamming diagram paper by a little bit, and this was by Cates and company. And so this is a reference now to his fragile states, their fragile states. So the idea is if I shear a layer, in this case of colloidal particles, I can develop a force network. Okay.
Colloidal athermal.
Oh, yeah, right. Okay. So there's nothing to break these particles apart in a thermal interaction. If I reverse the sense of strain, then this network will go away, and I will need to form another network. And so that's the sense of fragility, which is, so how precise a concept that is, is probably something to fight over. You know, are these states jammed? But, you know, so do you mean, you know, jammed in the sense that everything is in force and torque balance? Do you mean jammed in the sense that I have force and torque balance and I can apply strains, small but finite strains, and it won't go away? And those are somewhat different questions.
A quick question.
Yeah.
So you're talking about, I got the impression you're talking about end states, so there's a fragile state there that's dynamic.
Right.
And you talked about, well, what does fragile mean and how to, you know,
right,
torque and force balance.
Yep.
Then when I go the other way, am I walking through a set of similar states, or are those states different from the fragile one?
Yeah.
Other,
I think that's a great question, and I think that's part of the discussion. Right? Okay. So we're, in this case, we're going to do first what I call pure shear, and so that's where I keep the area of a rectangular sample a constant, but I deform it, so I shorten one boundary size and I grow the other one. Like so. Okay. So pushing things together in one direction. Okay, by the way, okay, so before I leave this, I mean, what I am going to call simple shear is where I deform, say, a rectangle into a parallelogram, but again, keep the area constant. And it's obvious we've already looked at coet shear. So all these things have in common the following, that there is a direction where the system is being compressed, and in other words, being expanded, right? So however you do it, that carries through. All right, so we're actually going to go back to this biaxial experiment, now I'm going to do kind of the experiment that Corey was alluding to, what happens if I compress my system and then reverse, right? So,
you want to turn the lights up?
Yeah, I don't know. It's okay, I can.
Left side.
Which left side?
Yeah.
Ah, here?
Yeah.
So which one is
it? Oh,
sorry. This, please? Yeah. Okay, I'm not going to. I think the one's over the. That's turning one. Okay, good.
No. I don't see anything.
Perfect. Is this normal? No. Okay. Poor Christ. All right. Never mind. Okay. So Corey underscored an important point. You don't see anything, right? This is a system which is prepared below a packing fraction of 0.84. Above that packing fraction, we always have jam states. That is, the forces in our system. But this is now had the forces relaxed, and so it's a zero stress state. And I'm simply going to shear it. The boundaries don't always stay in the picture in this particular system, but I'm pushing together vertically, expanding horizontally, always keeping the area constant strictly. Okay. And so what you discover is, okay, these go through something that look like fragile states, okay, but then they become very strongly jammed. Okay. Then you reverse the strain now, so that you're expanding vertically, coming in from the side. You develop a new network, okay, so I think this really was what Corey was alluding to, what happens when you reverse the strain. Okay, but again, there's no density change in this, right? Okay, density is never
changed. So you can come back to the same strain and
we're going to come back.
Stress looks very different, right? Yeah,
exactly, okay. So you come back.
You still have stress, even if you go back to the original.
Yeah, so that's the original boundary configuration.
Right now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So what you've done, okay, you started here, you've carried out actually a cycle of strain, right? So you've strained one way and you've reversed, okay, and you end up here, okay? But in between, of course, you've gone through a whole bunch of different kinds of states. Okay, so you have states which would almost surely qualify as fragile, okay, in the sense that they only have a force network in one direction. Okay, but then you end up with this system, right, where the forces, obviously, strong forces go from any boundary you pick to any other boundary. Okay, so.
And then if you cycle that one, then it stays roughly in that?
It will evolve more, okay, and so there's an interesting question which I'm going to leave for the debate. Well, no, it did well. What do you mean? So look at this one, and look what happens when I reverse, okay? So when I reverse, it goes to something that looks much more like the original state. Mm-hmm. So there's the outgoing strain. Mm-hmm. And now let's watch what happens when it comes back, whenever it does. Oh, there, okay. Mm-hmm. So it's not so different from the way it started, right?
Mm-hmm.
They're a different strain.
These are different strains, that's right. Okay.
No, but I think it is.
But the state, if you think of the system as having a state, then when I reverse the strain, okay, I dissolve the original force network and reform another one.
Well, you also have a configuration check when you push it to the end. You go back, you have a history, right?
There's definitely a history, right. Mm-hmm. Okay, I'm going to show you other experiments where the configurations change almost not at all. Okay, so don't forget these, you know, so this, I think, harkens back to the fact that these are frictional particles, mm-hmm. and I can make changes in the state of my system with minimal positional changes in my particles, but with non-trivial force changes of contents. So the question is, what is determining, what do you mean by configuration at the end of the day? And if you mean just those where the particles live, that's not the whole story. You also need to tell me what the forces are in the contents. Okay.
If you repeat this several cycles, would you not expect some residual stresses?
Hold that question, and I'll come back to that. I hope. Okay. Right. Okay. So now you end up with this picture, right? So we are living in a range here down to maybe, let's say 7.8, 0.79, up to about 0.84. Okay, where we can go through these fragile states with a force network going in one direction, no strong network in the other. But if we keep going, we end up there. Okay. All right. So now there's a problem with this experiment, which is For Karen, this is a great problem, okay? Because this system actually develops shear band. It doesn't remain completely homogeneous, and I don't want to belabor this. But. So if you actually look at what the particles are doing, so these are tracing displacements of particles between small strain steps. So you see it has this nice shear band, and when the system reverses, the shear band will do something else, okay? And so this is a great system for studying avalanches. It's a less than perfect system for studying other things because, for instance, if you look at density, there's a dilated region that develops when you're straining in one direction. There's strains which are anisotropic. And so, okay. So we wanted to have a system which remained more homogeneous. And so we went to great pains to create a system that would actually remain much more homogeneous under strain. You can understand why. I mean, the basic problem is if I just push from walls, okay, then what happens is, you know, I can push from one wall, push my system in, and that information will not propagate all the way across the system if I'm at low enough density, because the system is unjammed to begin with. I can jam some region, but if I'm outside the jamming region, there's no propagation of information. So I want to do something so that everybody knows that they're being sheared. Okay, all right. So the idea is that we have a simple shear experiment where we're straining, deforming rectangle to parallelogram, keeping area constant, but the base is articulated. So the particles are sitting on the base, there's very weak friction, but there's still friction with the base. When you strain, particles don't get left behind. Okay, so this is, you know, you've heard of no child left behind, this is no disc left behind. Okay, and so when you actually look at what particles do as you strain the system, along the direction of the displacement of the strain, particle, that's y here, particle, these are all, each is a particle, stayed at the end of the shear strain in the x direction, they scatter about the mean shear of the system in this direction, so that's where there's actually no motion of the boundaries, right, then particles again scatter, but there's no shear band developing. If you look at the density in the system, there are random fluctuations, this is coarse grain. But there's no shear band. Okay. All right. So now you might say, oh, well, okay, I got rid of the interesting stuff. If you now look at this system, of course, it happily jams on the shear. Okay, and in fact, you know.
Sorry, can you repeat how do you get this state without the shear band?
Yeah, sure. So the idea is that, this is what the experiment looks like, looking sort of down slightly from above. And the base of the system is a bunch of little strips. Mm-hmm. And each strip that moves in coordination with the other strips, so that the base is deforming along with the walls. Mm-hmm. Okay, and since the particles sit on the base, particles which don't ever experience any force, nevertheless are carried along. Mm-hmm. Okay? So, Now, you might say, okay, well, then, okay, there's still, you know, the base is messing you up, get rid of the base, which we can do, float our particles. Okay, actually, they got a bit slipperier. Okay, but they still happily shoot you. Okay. All right. So, okay. So if you sort of sum things up a little bit, right? So this is the packing fraction at which you get a shear jam state as a function of, sorry, these bizarre units of strain. So you start up here around 8.4. The system is already close to being jammed anyway. You don't need much shear strain to jam it. As you go down, you need more and more strain, and so this effectively tells you what phi s is. Okay. If you look at the networks, so this is from the pure shear experiments, and what you see is there's a percolation of the network in one direction for some amount of strain, and then for a larger strain, things percolate everywhere. And so you get the shear jamming diagram I showed you by taking many, many, many experiments, okay, and these are states where the system appears to be unjammed, states where it's more or less fragile, and states where we think it's jammed. Okay. Right. So there's an interesting thing here, which is in the experiment, which does not have a shear band, okay, we never find yield either. Okay. So what you call yield surface is a response to imperfections in the system from this point of view. Okay. Now, is that true everywhere? I don't know. Okay. But in our simple shear experiment, where things remain homogeneous on average, okay, they really remain homogeneous on average, and it never actually gets to a yield surface.
But you have small stress.
But you can have small stress drops, but then you just keep on going, you recover from that, and it will, the shear stress keeps growing and growing and growing, sort of, okay. So anyway, the idea is you have fragile states, and as in this picture, you get shear jam states, and then as you strain further, the system becomes more isotropic, okay, which means it has an interesting consequence, right? So, okay, so these are just networks associated with that. And so now the question is, how can we think of the role of friction? And so one thing that friction can do for you is, for instance, it can allow force structures that are much more curvy, okay, and are stable than if you have frictionless particles. So imagine these are three particles in a force chain, and I want to know if I can, if I just have, as an extreme case, just forces at these two contacts, okay, is that central particle in a force bound state? Okay, so again, this is a freshman physics calculation. Okay, I've sort of chosen my axes in a convenient way, and so I can, if I actually go through the appropriate calculation, okay, so the forces actually act, the forces of the two contacts have to be equal and opposite, they lie along that line. Okay, and so the upshot is there's only one non-zero eigenvalue for the force moment tensor associated with that particle, and the other eigenvalue is zero. Okay. That means that at the local level, this is maximally anisotropic force moment tensor. That's what you need to get large shear strengths. Right? Okay. The angle that you can accept here is the friction angle. Okay, so you can have this angle between this axis and the two contacts, theta, be as large as the friction angle, 10 nu. So that would suggest, so back to what happens if you decrease the friction between particles. Okay, this is an experiment. So this happens to be the original experimental data. This is the force reconstruction. And we're going to just do this for particles with a friction of about 0.7. Okay, so we're happily shearing away. Okay, we go through fragile, ultimately shear jam states of the system. Okay. Right. Okay, so enough is enough. You can see we've already seen this. It's getting a little boring. So now let's do it. So now this is hard. I mean, no, it's not hard. It just really requires a lot of patience. So you have to reduce the friction of the particles you had before. Okay, this is something, this is what experimentalists do. Okay, this is like debugging your code, only worse. So you take, you know, 1,000 particles and wrap them with Teflon tape. Okay, so now the friction coefficient is order of a tenth. Same density and so forth, same general experimental configuration.
You wrap on the top and bottom or on the side?
Oh, on the side, yeah. If I wrap them on the bottom, everything, I don't get any information. Right? I got to look through that direction.
Yeah.
But, okay. So, okay, yes, I get an effect. Okay, this is for the same amount of strain, the same density, but it's manifestly weaker. And so, in fact, what's happening is, yes, you can get to a shear drain state. You have to go further to get there, further in strain. So the effect occurs over a reduced range between phi s and phi j. Meanwhile, though, if you look at the mobilization of the contacts in the strong force chains, you may or may not be able to see that if you're sitting in the back row. You look along the force train. Okay, this is the mobilization, aka the tangential to normal force. If you walk along a force chain, you see that the mobilization is actually very low.
There must be a mu in there, right, Bob?
Oh, well.
FT over mu.
Yeah, sorry. Yes, there should be a mu. I have to divide by it. Okay. So, okay. All right. So, actually, let me just remind you, okay, so this, yeah, there was actually some science that came out of that experiment. Okay, so long forgotten. Hmm. The science was that this was actually a system that was demonstrating shear jamming. If you look at the P of S for these systems as a function of density, then you can get down to about 0.79, and that P of S then starts to develop this long exponential tail. That's the onset of shear jamming that was in this experiment. Okay. All right, so a quick comment, okay. What is this good for? Besides driving theorists crazy. Okay. What is it good for? Okay, so I think it actually occurs in lots of different configurations, systems, right? So this is actually just data for the shear band that you get when you shear in this experiment. You look at the packing fraction as a function of distance from that inner wheel moving outward radially. And so the packing fraction, after you sheared it, drops way down in density. Okay? This is a perfectly stable system, okay? So near the shearing wheel, where the density is really low, the system is still in force and torque balance. Okay? How could it do that, okay, if you couldn't have shear jam state? Okay, right. It does it because you have shear jam states. Otherwise, it's not possible to have that dilation. True? Okay. Let me propose that. You can challenge me later if you want. Corey is gone. Oh, never mind. Okay. The hard question is this. Oh, never mind. Okay. I'm going to look at this hopper flow experiment. Okay. Well, it's actually flowing, right? And so the red, I'm going to look in this region marked off by these two green bars. I'm going to look at the density and the pressure in that region. So G squared is essentially the pressure there. Density is fluctuating around this region. The possible error in this is, you know, maybe plus or minus 0.01, but not the, so that would be the systematic error might be 0.01, but the actual relative error is very tiny. So things are bouncing around a lot. They're in the shear jam regime in terms of density. Sometimes the system density goes up to here, but when it finally jams, the system density is no higher than it was instantaneously. So during that flow, you get from a flowing state to a jam state, and you never have to change the density very much. Okay, all right? So my bet, I'll call it a contention, is that these shear jam states are playing a role in lots of macroscopic flows that we just quietly ignore. Okay. All right. So I had promised that I was going to talk about something that would have to do with avalanches. Okay. Okay. And time is running on. Okay. So there's an interesting question of what it is that makes these states, okay, as opposed to protocols. And I'm willing to have that conversation with other people. I'll show you one piece of data. If you plot the shear stress and the pressure versus packing fraction, okay, you find that you have a mess from all those many, many different experimental realizations. If you take the same data for tau and p and plot it versus the fraction of non-Rattler particles, you get a very substantial collapse. Okay, so the point is that these are systems which have, in some sense, state variables. And you can fight over what the state variables might be. And one possibility is that you can have something which is an analog to a magnetic state variable. Okay, so I can, so for instance, if I look at shear stress versus strain, this has a beautiful hysteresis loop. So then tau would play the role, or if you like, the force moment version of tau would play the role of the extensive magnetization, and shear, which is an intensive variable, would act a little bit like magnetic field. And again, there's a long story on how you might do that, and that's something that Google has been using. Did you talk at all about that?
Yes, I've talked. I don't think I've talked about that, but I will at the conference.
Okay, so you can think of a local variable as being the force moment tensor, so the deviatoric part of the force moment tensor at the particle scale, and that you can associate that with two different spin matrices, and you can construct, if you like, a picture of a microscopic magnetization in the system. And again, I don't have time to go through all the details, but if you look at the trace of that, you know, this is now the magnetization, aka shear stress in the system. That's the simple shear one. It peaks, okay. It must be failing. Okay, must be failing, right? Everybody. Okay, how many says it failed because the shear stress peaked? Okay, how many don't want to stick their neck out? Okay.
I don't know what that S is. So
sorry, that's the shear stress. S is the shear stress,
that's
aka tau.
I'm sorry?
I
thought it was magnetization.
Yes, it's shear stress. If you want to think in conventional terms, it's the magnetization. If you want to think of this as a magnetic analog. Okay. So tau is the shear stress as a function of strain, and it has a peak.
Is that the yield stress?
Right. So that's the question. Is it the yield stress? Does it have a yield stress? Any yield stress? Okay. So the traditional picture is when tau reaches a peak, you've reached the yield stress. True.
No.
Okay.
No.
Okay, all right. It's certainly true in soil mechanics.
Yes.
Okay, this is a granular system. Okay, so in soil mechanics, that would be the yield stress, and in actual fact, it's only because the principal eigenvalues are the shear stress are approaching each other. The system is just getting more isotropic. Okay, right? And so if you look at something which is more like this is now you take the magnitude of the local force moment tensor and sum it, okay, and that actually flattens off. So this system is just getting more isotropic. Okay? All right, so again, a long, long story. Okay. For Jim, I would show you why there might be a temperature, but again, I don't think I have time. But, okay, so I want to do. Okay, so I want to tell you, we can do this now in three dimensions, okay, and that's as much as I'm going to tell you. Except I'll show you a picture. So now in three dimensions, you can now, by some magic, okay, you can now measure where particles are, and you can measure the forces between particles. And again, that's part of another talk. Okay. I will show you a picture. Okay. So these are real particles. Okay, which you image, and you determine the forces between particles by looking at deformation. And so then, as the system is, you're looking, this is real data, this is not a Star Wars movie, and so this is now the remnant of the strong force network in the system. So these are the force chains. Okay, but somewhere along that line, I had promised Carmen I'd say something about avalanches. And so one way to look at avalanches is to say, okay, I'm going to take my photoelastic particles and I'm going to take a channel full of them. So let me just look at this upper figure. I have a channel of them oriented vertically, and I'm going to put something rough on top and I'm going to drag it across. Okay. And so then as I drag it across, I'll measure the force of pulling. Okay. And so now at the same time, though, I want to correlate what the pulling force is, so you can see this is the pulling force versus time, okay?
And rough system spinning?
Say again.
What is your thing you put on top of the?
Yeah, it's
graph system spanning object you move?
No, it's a boat. Okay, so you can see the object here in black, as opposed to sort of dark. Okay, so there's the object. Okay, it tilts a little bit.
What is the size compared to in the system size?
Yeah, so the system size sort of is there to there. Okay, so it would start at one end of the blackboard and go to the other end of the blackboard.
I guess the other relevant length scale would be how deep it is compared to the length of the boat.
Correct. Yeah, so this is most of the depth, I think.
Okay. So it's comparable, the size of the boat is comparable.
In this case, yeah. I don't know that that's essential. Okay. If it were tiny, it would be essential. Or
that was sort of what I was getting at.
But it's large compared to this sort of the depth. It's comparable or larger than the depth. Okay, so now the question is, you know, what does this look like? And so this is a system which I think, at the end of the day, is different from what Karin is thinking about, because there's clearly inertia. You're pulling through a spring, so the elasticity is set by that pulling spring. If you look at the force on that spring, it's climbing, and this, of course, does have failure events. It'll be a little one now, okay, so I can post-dict where the avalanches will occur. And so one of the interesting things is what's going on internally as the system is slipping, and you can see the force chains are actually bending in response to the shear. Okay. So now pulling. Okay. So small readjustment. Those the force chains are pushed over laterally. Okay, and there will be a big earthquake now. Okay.
Are you trying to bury the spring? Which
yep.
You are pulling?
Yeah.
I mean, you should get bigger force drops.
Yeah, so right. So there's, indeed this depends. There's an effective elasticity, which is the spring constant, and the material elasticity. So yes, we have varied that, and it does affect the details, but perhaps more interesting is also how fast you're pulling relative to this distance.
And the packing fraction?
We're kind of stuck with that. Okay, so gravity tends to tell us what the packing fraction will be. Okay, so then the idea is, what is the distribution of these stress drops? This is actually converted to energy drops, and so now the exponent here, which you might want to somehow match to, say, a Gutenberg-Richter law, is a little bit bigger than 1. Okay. But again, this is not Karin's system, I don't think. So the actual slip events, so for instance, if you look at the velocity during a slip event, it is a complex shape. Okay, so I don't think you would ever call that a parabola, but again, statistically, you might get a parabola out of that. And so again, I don't want to spend as much time on that, but rather, let's go back. So now there is no external elasticity in the system, that is strictly the system elasticity in this shear experiment. Each of these spikes, particularly when you're going slowly, if you blow them up, correspond to some buildup and relaxation of stress. And so then we can look at, for instance, what those distributions might be, right? In particular, as a function of how fast we're pulling. So this is data that
and these are above what you would call these 5J?
No, these are above 5S, these are below 5J. So these are in the shear jamming regime.
Okay.
If you try to go much above 5J, the system just gets so much stress in it, it becomes unstable and buckles out of the plane. So this would live in the shear jamming regime, I think. And now when you're pulling very slowly, or shearing very slowly, then, for instance, the stress drops look roughly like this. These are the rate of stress drops, as a function of shear rate. So when you're going very slowly, you typically are looking at close to one event at a time. When you're going very fast, then of course you're merging many events at one time. Okay, so then this is then the results from Karin's analysis of that data and so various exponents which she has tried to extract from, she and her student have tried to extract from that data. And I assume you're going to talk more about this next week. So, so in a way, this is mostly an advertisement. Okay. All right. So again, you could go back to the simple shear experiment. And so there's data from that, which is sort of fresh off the press, but time is, it's not going to be that different from what we've been talking about so far. So There was actually supposed to be a summary slide. Okay, so I lost my summary slide, so somewhere, which I won't try and find. Okay, so basically what I've tried to do is really inform this discussion of what is the nature of shear jamming in your system. Okay, shear jamming is something where you can have well-defined state variables. Friction is clearly important. Okay, whether you can do it with or without friction as well is, I think, something that Stefan will talk to if I give him half a chance and shut up. Really want to just hammer in the idea that there is, in fact, a set of states which exist for friction null particles that do not have such a simple analog when you get rid of friction, and that extra degree of freedom gives you this much more complex jamming diagram. And this is what I think real particles do, right? Okay, so real granular particles. Okay, if you want to talk about emulsions or something like that, where the particles have no friction, then I think you can go back and look at the frictionless jamming diagram. If you want to talk about grains, even spherical grains, in a real world setting, you've got to put the friction in, and that shifts the jamming diagram. And then I would say that the question that was raised at the beginning of the talk by Corey is, what happens to that jamming picture as you change phi? That's probably the important open question theoretically at the moment. Okay, so.
As you change mu.
Sorry. Okay. Punch. Okay. Good. Okay. Thanks.
Okay. I guess one question I have about your six-lift compare is, do you observe a parameter review where six-lift compressor is not
there? Well, it's definitely six-lift, yeah. Okay.
And for all values of the shear rate.
No. So I didn't show you what happens when you go fast enough. So for instance, if you look at the pulling experiment, as I go faster, I get into an inertial region, and so instead of getting, I get oscillatory motion with a characteristic frequency which is set by the spring constant of the puller and the mass of the slider. Okay, so what I was showing you was stick slip only.
But you're always getting stick slip in the slow region.
Yep. Okay.
Yeah, you said that you could monitor the rotation, but actually you didn't say
much. I didn't say much about that, yeah.
So I wonder if you're under flow and you track particles and you look how much they have displaced and how much they have rotated.
Okay,
is
yes.
Just
yeah.
Proportional roughly?
This is it. Well, I'm getting close. This might actually get a little bit to your question. So what I want to do is I want to look at cyclic shear. So I'm going to take this simple shear experiment where I keep my system homogeneous, where I don't break it, and I'm just going to shear forward and back, shear forward and back, shear forward and back. And so if I then look at so every time I come back to the original configuration, so the unquote unstrained configuration, okay, I'll take a set of images, including ones that show rotation and displacement. And so this is that's the stress, okay? And so that's fluctuating a lot. I mean, the system breathes a bit, but on average, of course, that's a short segment.
Is that a small amplitude oscillation?
Yes, so now let's look at where the particles are actually going. And how much rotation they have. So they do have a certain amount of rotation, but the particles aren't going anywhere on average because they're locked into place. And since they don't have a lot of defects, I can shear pretty far, I can do a lot of shearing, and they'll never escape from their cage. So they stay. The amplitude would figure on that. Okay, there's a finite range of amplitude in that experiment. Okay, we're now building, almost completed, a system where we can shear ad infinitum, which is a coet geometry, but with a split configuration.
And here I could ask what this then means for displacement and what this means for angular displacement.
Yeah. And so, indeed. So, let's see if I have that. I don't know if I have that. So in short, you have, if you are below shear jamming, you actually see something, so you're pushing particles around, but it's sort of collisional. And you see something which is, let me see if I can get my story remember correctly. So the rotational diffusion is always has a diffusion exponent which is bigger than one. Okay, so it looks super diffusive in terms of the rotational diffusion. Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. If you look at the positional diffusion, then when you're below shear jamming, it is also super diffusive. But once you get into the regime where you're really driven by the persistent contacts between the particles, then it becomes much closer to normal diffusion than the exponent for the RMS.
While the angular diffusion is...
But the angular diffusion always looks super diffusive.
Yeah.
Okay. So I don't know why. Okay. So.
Even as you approach 5J?
Yeah, it doesn't seem to change very much. The exponent, I think, is always about 1.5. I mean, I can dig that data up, but I think by the time I search for it, you'll waste all your time.
Mm-hmm. Other question?
Yep. Yes, please. So, my recollection was the Quirt experiments were at a Raja packing fraction, but they're not. They were around the shear jamming, the Quirt.
The Quirt experiments?
Still around the shear jamming packing fraction.
Right.
But you think of that as being compressed enough that it's elastic? And there's density variation across, right?
Sure. So there's definitely density dependence in there. But I think it ranges from states which are relatively fragile to states which are robustly jammed.
Depending on where you are and that's in the system?
Yes, that too. Because, of course, the density is low close to the... If you're in the shear band region, then for sure you're living close to the fragile regime. In the sense that you have a very long skinny network, and then as you move outward, I can show you
that. That's what I'm saying. It's inhomogeneous,
so it's not the optimum system for studying that, but it has features which depend on the fact you can have shear jamming.
And where do you measure these, the avalanches, the stress drops?
Where
is that measured?
So they're measured in some angular span, sort of a pie-shaped slice, which is maybe 10 or 20% of the system. But you span the radial direction.
So you have all of the density variation in there.
You have all the density variation, but maybe you don't care because the forces are imbalanced. And so when you break a piece of the network, it affects the whole system. But
no, that I understand. But if you're comparing to parents, parents is an elastic system. So that's
yeah, oh yeah, well, this, yeah, well, it is.
But the fact that
there is elasticity in it, right? In the sense that if I break something here, that information propagates further away. So there is
a force space, but in position space,
you have a force network. You break a piece of it, and so elsewhere you know about it. But
it's a very different picture from the one that I got yesterday, where when I have a shear band in the bulk metallic glass,
mm-hmm.
The reason that I thought mean field works is because I was sort of elastically coupling weak spots along the shear.
Yeah. So.
Whereas, sort of, if I understand, because I had the exact same question as Google actually, in these Couette cells, I had a shear band that's localized near the center ring.
Yeah.
Right? And that's where most of the deformation takes.
The strain is taking place there.
And
that's right.
That seems like a very, I don't know how to understand it, but it seems like a very different picture than the one we saw yesterday from Wendy.
So the picture which I think is more promising, where we have data literally that's like a couple of days old, right? Okay, so
no, Bob, I think the question is, why do they look so similar? Like Wendy's,
but look at this is awesome.
Well, so now, okay, so this is now this pure shear experiment, and we'll just drive it. And so I don't know how good you are.
I don't understand what's happening.
I'm sharing it. Pure shear, compression, and expansion.
So you're compressing this way and letting it expand that way.
Mm-hmm. The other way around, but that's okay.
By the dark bands.
That's just the apparatus, which is blacked out. Okay. So now, that's a little bit. So first of all, the particles are elastic, and you have system spanning structures. That doesn't necessarily mean that the global system has an elastic response,
that's
which
that's
is what Google
asking,
is
which is
asking
from
about.
Glasses, yeah.
So it's not a continuum elastic system in that sense.
How do you know?
But if I actually look, it depends on where you live, of course, in this system state. But for instance, think about the shear jamming process itself. I start from a zero stress state, including T. Yeah. I apply shear strain, and the pressure grows. How is it going to grow? It can't depend on the sign of the strain. P is a scalar. And so, in fact, P grows quadratically in the strain. Okay. So.
But that's a nonlinear elastic.
No,
even
non-linear.
Okay, yeah, that. So it may come down to a question of vocabulary, but it is a very unusual non-linear elasticity.
It's a pressure that going with shear strain squared, Jim. It's not non-linear elasticity.
Yeah.
But that's what people have been saying, I think, since the 19th century.
What have they been saying?
That you use shear, and then there's a second order effect.
Yeah, right, but there's no first order effect.
Well, it can't be by
well, I mean, of course, there's a coupling to the shear stress. To the shear stress also grows or changes with shear strain. When I reverse the shear strain, I reverse on a different path. So it's not linearly reversible, even when it's shear jammed. Right? So there, on two fronts, it is an odd. So there's an extreme case, if you want, of the second order effect, the coupling between strain and pressure. When you look at shear stress versus strain, it has this non-reversibility feature. So it's sort of, if you want to think of it as elastic, it certainly depends on the fact that the grains are elastic.
Yeah, but amorphous materials that do have elasticity, you have the second order effect in the shear, and
yep.
It will also have a degree of
non-reversibility. Yeah, okay. Yeah.
But there is an elastic regime, Jim, correct?
So where is
in
where
metallic
is,
glasses?
Yeah.
So where
there is no elastic regime here.
Yeah, the problem is finding a linear elastic regime.
There is no linear elastic regime in this system.
Well, okay. That's
so,
what it's interesting. I'm just trying
that's
to,
what I'm
just
yeah.
So that's why it's different. And so
right.
My question was, if Karen's model explains the exponents here and in Wendy's, I think they're very different systems as far as linear
right.
elasticity
goes. It's not obvious to me that linear elastic regime is relevant though, to this. So that's another question.
No, but your things are coupled elastically, right?
Yeah.
Well, So you can turn the question around, how essential is that?
Yeah.
Linear elasticity.
Well, linear
to what
elasticity is sort of what's conveying the forces to
Are you saying, Karen, that the mean field exponents are the same even if you have nonlinear elasticity in your model?
Well, that would be
I'm not
committing
anyway. But
we
just looked at this. I mean, it made sense to me that at high packing fractions with these elastic grains, I cannot see in the physics an essential difference because if he has a fairly densely packed grains, I would expect something.
But they're not fairly densely packed, right? They're bordering the shear jamming regime, and that's why I was asking Bob if he was measuring it only in the densely packed area. I would agree, but his radial section is panning densities
right.
that
but
jam the shear
but
jamming.
Yeah, but let's look at
this is one of the
and the shear band is at the low density
in the region.
Region.
That's
okay.
The low density region. That's what I'm confused about.
Maybe let him respond.
Yeah. So I mean, I think it would be useful. So I agree that the coed experiment is a difficult system to match in a clean way to what Karen is trying to describe.
Mm-hmm.
It's not obvious that it's going to be. I mean, it could be, right? So we could take a piece of Jim and a piece of Karen and a piece of Bubble and cook up a model. Which piece do you want to contribute?
This is exactly what I think this fact is most interesting. What's the distinguishing features between these different kinds of systems? One absolutely obvious thing here is that the kinds of systems that I've been playing with, metallic glass, or other, maybe even real glasses, The force chain idea isn't relevant.
Yeah.
At least maybe to very low temperatures and very small perturbations, but that's not a normal situation. Here, things seem to be really dominated
by what forces?
By the fact that the force chains propagate from over very long distances, usually from one side of the system to another.
They have to. They have to if you're in 4 cells.
That's right. And
they cannot end it with a
question. Sort of right.
But that is a qualitatively different kind of thing. And now, as a theorist, I think to myself, well, how the hell are we going to describe this? And I looked at Vogel, and she's beginning to have some ideas about how to do that in ways that I had never dreamed of.
I'm glad I made it.
Where there are these intrinsic long-range interactions that are controlling what's going on. And I think that's quite a distinct universality class, if you like to say that.
Right, so I think what both Lisa and I are trying to get at is
how does Karin's wonderful theory work?
Well, exactly. Lisa was asking, and you're asking, and I'm asking, is what's Karin's theory got in it?
That captures both of them.
It captures both, or does it really? Yeah. And so we have to pin her down a little bit harder than we're going to next week.
Yeah, sounds good.
You're welcome, Karin. So I mean, this system is cleaner system than the coin experiment. Is one bottom line on that, right?
Yeah.
Because you're not dependent upon this ever-growing, extraordinary robust shear band. It still has a shear band. Otherwise, it doesn't break. Okay. Or if it breaks, it forms a shear band.
So this isn't the one with the slats underneath it?
No, because that doesn't break, or it doesn't break much.
Great.
Okay, so this is the pure shear one. It gets a shear band in the middle.
But Bob, why can't we look at the distribution of the small stress drops in the one that has no shear band?
Of course you can. It just takes a lot more patience. If you get,
Actually, I think it would be really interesting to know the difference because, based on sort of the dilation that you see and stuff like that, I might expect that actually there's two different mechanisms that interplay in one versus the other, right? And you learn a lot from comparing the two.
Right. So, and one picture is why do force chains break? And that's one way that your system fails, right? And so one way that they break is you have two grains in a chain and one slips past the other. Okay? It's probably much more like an STZ then. The other mechanism you can have is some grain between two others rolls out of the way. Okay, it's stabilized against that by sort of buffering grains that are only weakly forced as neighbors. The force chain is just as broken at the end of that process, but one is sort of a continuous process that depends on the evolution of the strain. The other is something where you actually literally break the contact. The origin of the event is localized because you're looking at a region that involves either two or three grains. Yeah. So it's pretty local.
A little bit of hope that you can make some sort of a statistical description.
Yes. Right. Right.
And you might actually think that the two ones you described, where you break where it's sort of switching, would be more like an elastic coupling between these defects, and the one where particles sort of move out of the way would be sort of like an effective temperature coupling between defects, perhaps.
Yeah, maybe, right? I mean, there's lots of effective temperature games you might want to. I'm not picking that one up. Sorry.
It's okay, Jim.
Do you have a shovel? No.
Okay. But Bob, could you just repeat what you said? Something about the shear bands in this biaxial.
Yeah. So if I may. Yes, yeah. So let me. It's because.
Can you show a shear band? Because I didn't see any. You're talking about shear bands.
Maybe
like
what
see.
He said.
Yeah. Okay.
Let me
show the shear band, and then I'll get your question. So these are particle displacements, and there's the shear band.
But it keeps moving.
In
most people's picture, a shear band is a fixed thing.
It depends. No, it'll totally reverse. Because all over the world.
Yeah, there's not much movement.
I'm sorry.
There's a place where there is not much movement.
I've seen sort of collective
There's lots of collective movement, but part of it is organized into their diagonal structures where
you get. But that's only because the shear stresses are biggest along the diagonal.
Yeah.
That's true. But if you actually look, I mean, there are block-like structures where there's basically throughout the whole block.
I think we ought to reserve the term shear band for something that is irreversible that really leaves a mark on the system.
Well, it has to leave a mark so that but you're thinking of continued shear. If I continue the shear, that band would stay there.
If a shear band forms, it localizes in this geometry.
Right.
It localizes the shear, and that's just what you saw.
Yesterday
is that it leaves a permanent impression and undergoes a really irreversible.
Right.
Not necessarily this way, because there are a lot of shearing events, right?
But
go ahead. Spontaneous. And they form and disappear.
Well, I'm just talking about a useful definition. I'm writing a semantic suggestion.
Yeah.
That's the way we should discuss.
So, so we can call it a shear band sub JL for Jim Langer. But I mean, don't forget, these systems are being reversed.
Yeah.
So Wendy doesn't reverse her system.
Yeah.
She just keeps chugging right along.
Yeah.
And she can't reverse her system, I don't think. She would have to reform but this system, when you reverse it, it's not thermal, there's no thermal threshold to reforming my system when I reverse it.
Well,
Wendy doesn't have that capability. But it doesn't mean that you couldn't imagine doing that in a computation.
No, but if Wendy reversed your system, it wouldn't go back to
Yes, because there's a tremendous energy barrier to reforming the surface.
You'd be able to look at it and see, that's a mess compared to what she started with, okay?
True, right. But that, I think that's a,
yeah.
I think that points to a difference between a non-cohesive granular system and a cohesive metallic glass, any kind of molecular system.
How do you define a shear band in the system?
So it's two aspects, I think. One is strain localization. Mm-hmm. There's no question there's strain localization. And the other is dilation. Mm-hmm. And in the granular case, it really Onsgaard dilates.
But there's a continuous band over which I can find out?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean,
I looked at Dejan and see it's very spotty.
No,
it doesn't expand the system.
It does. You have to actually look at the density,
okay.
Right? So I actually showed that at the beginning of the talk, where you actually look at the dilation in the middle.
Yeah, there was one figure you had where you showed the permanent dilation along one.
Yeah, and that was the Wendy experiment where it was sheared in one direction.
Yeah.
It dilated along that diagonal shear band, and it would stay there unless I reversed it. And because it's a non-cohesive system, when I reverse it, it tends to forget.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
It tends to what?
Forget that
because
I shared it.
It forgets that it was.
Yeah. Actually, I mean, it does. There is memory. Okay, so it's not quite that simple, but it is a very small memory effect.
Look, one of the things that is interesting is granular material in an earthquake fault gouge.
Yep.
There you shear it, mm-hmm. You actually, under many circumstances, with bigger earthquakes, you make a shear band,
mm-hmm.
And by golly, then when the next earthquake comes, it likes that place.
Right, but you keep...
That's 100 years later. And
sure, but it never... Yeah, and if I froze my system, it wouldn't forget. It's there. You know, these experiments, they look like they're taking place in real time.
Yeah.
They're taking place... Not exactly on geological timescales, but they're slow. They're slow. So you shear and you stop.
Yeah.
Okay. And of course the trick is how long you have to stop. We've actually, we stop less and less the more efficient we become. But in the original experiment, the first cyclic shear one cycle was a week. Okay. Every state you stop, do a bunch of imaging, 20 minutes later you move it again. You have not destroyed the state of that system by waiting 20 minutes.
What was there that could have perturbed it at all?
Well, friction between contacts is still you know, that still ages. You still have aging between these edges. Well, it's friction, right? It's real eye friction. Friction, real eye friction ages. It's a thermal process, and so that's present. And so if you wait really long times, okay, if you wait, you know, a day, then there will be some relaxation of frictional contacts and the system will change. But if you wait a long time compared to how long it took to prepare the particular state, but not that long, yeah, it doesn't change. And you know, in the earthquake zone, things are terribly locked up. Okay, you're not going anywhere. There's no degree of freedom even if you have a little local slip.
The rock experiments that people do in the labs.
They all have aging.
Yeah.
They all age. But logarithmic is so. Mm-hmm. So the difference between a day and 100 years may or may not be that great.
So maybe on that note, let's thank him again for a fantastic talk. The men, we have one more lunch discussion today. So if you can just all run, grab your lunch, come back,